Hello there, I'm Chris Difford. Welcome to my podcast, I Never Thought It Would Happen, made in collaboration with Help Musicians. Help Musicians is an amazing charity that has been aiding artists for 100 years, supporting a myriad of music creators throughout the UK. From financial support to mentoring to mental health issues and everything in between. In each episode of this podcast, I'll be joined by musical friends to discuss their careers, from the highs and the lows, and how they actually create the work that you know and love. In this episode, I'll be joined by a truly inspirational musician, a member of the UK's biggest boy band. When at the height of their fame and their power, he decided to walk away and follow his own journey in life, which turned out to be a really smart move, as he bounced back to an even bigger audience, smashing records everywhere he went. He sold more albums than any UK solo artist, and he's won 18 Brit Awards. You'll never find him leaning over the garden fence, sharing gardening tips with his neighbour Jimmy Page. But if you want somebody to entertain you, look no further. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Robbie Williams. Hey Robbie, welcome to I Never Thought It Would Happen, a podcast with me and Help Musicians. How are you?
Mr. Difford, I'm really good. Yeah, I'm in this moment where the sea can be quite choppy mentally, emotionally. Yeah. I'm pretty good. I can't complain, although I'm creative and I could come up with a few things, but all good. How are you?
I'm good. Have you survived this whole lockdown stuff?
To be honest with you, I get ample opportunity to be with my four children. My eldest one is 8 and my youngest is 1. And I'm very fortunate to be in a financial situation where I'm okay, at least for a while.
That's great.
So I've just been with my children. And amazing. When we come out of this, and we will, when we come out of this, they probably won't get that much of me again for a very long time. So it's been, you know, I understand what's happening with the world, but for me, it's kind of been manna from heaven that I've been able to be a dad.
What was it like for you when you were their age? Did you hang out with your parents a lot?
Well, my mum and dad ran a pub.
Did they?
Yeah, they ran a pub called the Red Lion. And it's in Burslem in Stoke-on-Trent. And it's very time-consuming running a pub. It's open in the afternoon. And then, you know, there's the half-time, you know, late afternoon before it opens again in the evening. And what I remember is that I was always surrounded by adults that were either in the pub or worked at the pub. And it's kind of like when you are 2, 3, and 4, which I was, it's kind of like being a celebrity without the hassle. You're just like, everybody thinks you're amazing.
Yeah.
And whatever you do is hilarious.
Of course.
And they can't wait to see you and their eyes light up. My mom was very busy. My mom and my dad were divorcing. So I was obviously too young to understand the concept of that or understand what was going on. Mm. But all I remember from that was kind of being a tiny celebrity, which all children are, given the right love. So,
and of course, when children are like that, you have to give them treats.
Oh, yes, which probably started the sugar addiction.
Of course.
For me. And, you know, we are currently working our way around food and it being an addiction for me, and the way that we talk about ourselves and food in relationship with the kids.
Yeah.
So that was the segue I picked up from you mentioning treats.
Yeah, I know what you mean. So when you were in the pub there, did you have your own room? Did you have like a space where you could be Robbie?
I left there when I was 4 or 5. And then we moved to a house in Tunstall that was opposite a pub called the Ancient Britain. And the house that we moved to, it was a road that went up the middle of two council estates. So yeah. There was a council estate on the left, and then there was a council estate on the right. And the house that we moved into was owned. It wasn't owned by the council. It was owned by my mum.
Wow.
Which may as well have been the Queen, you know. But it wasn't a well-to-do house in any sort of way. It just wasn't a council house.
Right.
So I kind of lived on this street of the owned houses in between the two council estates, which kind of causes a sense of being other, you know. So I went from the pub to this owned house. Like I say, it was opposite the ancient Brit. And when you were growing up, especially in England, drinking as a culture is as pervasive as breathing. And that's what you do. You sort of, the school gates close and the pub doors open. And that's the natural right and the natural progression. So you can double and triple that with a pub being the center focus of what I see when I look out of my bedroom window.
But in that house, that owned house, was there lots of music to keep you warm?
There was a pile of vinyls, and I think it's what my dad left. I think that's the story that I've told myself. And in that vinyl was Mal Torme and Sarah Vaughan, Nat King Cole, the Rat Pack, Glenn Miller. There was a Mr. Men vinyl too. It was voiced by Arthur Lowe.
Was it?
Yeah. So my very, very early vinyl memories are all of these people from the 50s and 60s and Arthur Lowe voicing Mr. Men stories.
But when did you get a sort of tickle for music? When did you sort of start thinking, this is something that interests me, this is going to be in my blood?
Well, it was when I was about 8 or 9, my sister, for my birthday, bought me 2 albums.
Yeah.
And one of them was Pink Floyd, The Wall. And the other one was a compilation album of street sounds that was called Electro One. And Electro One had the very, very early hip-hop rap stuff that was, you know...
Yeah.
Brooklyn was listening to Kraftwerk and then reinterpreting Kraftwerk with words on the top of it. And the Pink Floyd thing, I didn't get at all.
No.
I must have put the needle on the record and it did not speak to me. But then I put the needle on the record with Electro One and went, this is what I'm about. You know, and I sort of revisit Electro One, and it's very much instrumental. There's some that have words on it, but it's more, more dance. It's more Kraftwerk-esque.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, considering I'm a big fan of words, like a massive, massive fan of words, the musical landscape was purely musical. It was purely instrumental. And I guess it must have taken me to a place where I felt safe or invigorated or tough when I wasn't really tough.
Yeah.
And it was around about the time that the film Beat Street came out, and Electric Boogaloo, and there was the graffiti phase. But that was kind of my tribe. I'd looked around and I'd seen people wearing parkas, and they were something called mods.
Yeah.
Then I saw people with skinheads, and they were something called skinheads. And at that particular time, and still probably a little bit today, I'm a chameleon and just want to be whatever it is that those people are.
Sure. Did you have posters on your wall?
Well, actually, the first thing that I wanted to be was a teddy boy.
Oh, right. Because of?
Because at the pub, this was pre being 5, I just absolutely loved Show Oddy Woddy.
Oh, no.
Hey, listen, I was 5. And then my mum took me to see Shawaddy Waddy, and I wanted the Teddy Boy outfit. And did I have posters on my wall? I eventually did when I became a little bit older, but the first posters on my wall were from a magazine called Match and Shoot.
Right.
And Match and Shoot was a football magazine.
Yes, of course, yeah.
There wasn't an inch free on my wall that wasn't devoted to football.
I was in Skegness a couple of years ago, and Shawaddy Waddy were playing the following night. And I looked at the poster, and I couldn't believe that they looked exactly the same.
Well, you know, there's a lot you can do with Photoshop.
Exactly, that's what I thought.
Yeah.
But yeah, so you quickly moved along, and when you were looking into the lyrical future, who were you listening to? You know, what was inspiring you as a lyricist?
Well, I suppose War of the Worlds was a big album too.
Was it?
Because we had War of the Worlds at the house. Ian Dury.
Of course.
Yeah.
Did you ever meet him?
Yeah, I did.
What was he like?
So he worked for UNICEF, and my makeup artist was his makeup artist. And we got together, and he introduced me to UNICEF, and I became an ambassador for UNICEF because of Ian Dury. And then I created a TV show called Soccer Aid.
Yeah.
You know, so the money for that goes to UNICEF. So everything that we've raised for UNICEF, actually, the root of it is Ian Dury. And what was he like? He was very nice to me, but I think his health wasn't very good. Mm. And outside of me, I think he was untrusting of journalists. You know, it's like I would say that his bullshit meter was working in overtime.
Sure.
And he couldn't and wouldn't put up with anything that he deemed to be bullshit.
But when you first put pen to paper, this was probably before you met him, I guess. When did you start to discover that you could write lyrics yourself?
Well, I wrote bits and bobs of poetry at school, but nothing of note and nothing that I can really remember. And I joined Take That when I was 16. I just left school. I had no qualifications. I'm very, very dyslexic, but it was at a time when dyslexia didn't exist. So I was just stupid. Mm. And I'm kind of only just cancelling those thoughts now. So I had no qualifications. There was no future. And I auditioned for a thing called Take That, and I got in. And the first 18 months was spent doing gay clubs up and down the UK. And through a series of events, basically what happened was this. Our manager relented and let us do under 18 clubs, and it just went absolutely mental. We went around to record companies, and boy bands had died a death. Hmm. This was the age of Seattle and grunge. And New Kids on the Block were passé. Mm-hmm. And nobody was taking a chance on signing boy bands. But what we did was, through hard work and through hard graft, is we had these cards with a P.O. box on the back. And we'd do a school assembly in the morning, school assembly in the afternoon, a youth club, an under-18s club, an over-18s club, and a couple of gay clubs. And that would be like the daily sort of grind. Well, and we managed to get tens of thousands of these cards signed, and we had a database of names. And I'm thinking it was something between like 20,000 to 30,000 of these names. And basically what I understand, if I'm telling the story right and if I'm remembering right, BMG bought the database and not the band.
No way.
They gave us a contract.
Yeah.
But basically, they were taking a punt on the data that we'd collected.
Wow.
As opposed to signing this boy band and thinking that they got a future. Anyway, we got lucky. One thing leads to another. We have a couple of hits. Everything blows up and off we go. And I kind of remembered to myself, well, hang on, I did write poetry at school. Perhaps I should have a go at jotting something down. You know, I felt as though I was some sort of wordsmith, whether that be good, bad, indifferent, I didn't know, but I felt as though I could do it. I remember being on tour with Lulu, and she was in the tour bus with us around Europe, and I sat in the back and I wrote this poem, and it was called Hello, Sir. And it was about my school and my careers officer advising me to join the army, poo-pooing the idea that I could sing and dance or that I could act or whatever. And I realized that it was quite good. I know that sounds egoic. No. I knew that it was something. I knew that it existed in a territory outside of shit.
Sure. So that's when the songwriter arrived, I guess.
Yes.
How did that go down with the rest of the band?
Well, you know, Gary was the only one really being managed in the band.
Okay.
You know, he was the proven songwriting talent. And at the time, because of the age, it was very much Lord of the Flies. And Gaz had, quite rightly, learnt his craft on the piano since he was 8 or 9. And I think basically what happened with Take That was Nigel, the manager, threw a bunch of boys around Gary to carry the weight.
Yeah.
Because Gaz had sent in a demo and it had a million love songs on it. I don't know if you remember a million love songs.
Yeah, absolutely.
There was some gold in these demos. And I think he threw us around Gaz as a protection blanket to carry the weight. And what happened was Gaz was super driven, super ambitious, super protective, and he didn't want to give away any names in the brackets. And Nigel Martin Smith wasn't about to say to any of the other lads, hey, you should have a go at this too.
Right.
So writing music for me at that point was in the realms of the special unicorn. You'd been touched with the special stick and everybody else hasn't.
Yeah.
So I was dealing with writing songs is for the gods. And also Gaz doesn't want me to do it.
No, of course not.
Because he spent all of this time learning his craft. And then these Johnny come latelys arrive and take away a percentage. Fuck that. So it was
very common.
Yeah, it was kind of like,
it's common in a band, isn't it?
Yeah. You add that in with us all being in our teens at a time when they're all booking Broncos, jostling for position in a Lord of the Flies style,
yeah,
you know, dance. It's toxic.
It is, and you always came across as the naughty one.
That was my role. I was brought up backstage because my dad's a comedian. He won his round in New Faces in 1974, and I grew up around cabaret with my father, and I instinctively knew that you fill a space with your personality.
Mm.
And whether that be right or wrong, you're going to need to fill a space to make a mark.
Mm.
And my role was being the cheeky, the naughty, the rock and roll, if you like. But sure, it was all, not that I would know it at the time, performance art, all kind of low level. But, you know, I'm not saying that it exists in the pantheon of Marcel Marceau and so on and so forth. But like what I was doing was naturally filling a space and placing down my marker of I am somebody. I exist with this personality.
When did you get the twitch to go, you know what, I can do this down on my own 2 feet?
It was kind of cocaine and Britpop.
Yeah.
And being influenced by The Enemy, Melody Maker, The Face, Select magazine, Jarvis Cocker arriving, that I kind of feel was in the same pantheon as Ian Dury lyrically.
Sure. Yeah.
And the stuff that he was writing about, that very much inspired me. Common people inspired me. Boys Who Like Girls Who Like Boys Who Like Girls with Blur. And now I'm reaching 18 and 19, where you're in that sweet spot of developing your musical personality and what you do and don't like. And it becomes kind of religious. I am this tribe and fuck everybody else. But I kind of wasn't allowed to be in one of those tribes because I was in a Lily White pop group.
That must have been a difficult discussion to have with the other members of the band if they were Lily White and you wanted to go off.
Well, I remember phoning Gaz and I sang him a song that I put together just top line melodically in my head, and it was about a prostitute in Manchester. And there was silence at the end of the phone call that felt like it lasted forever. Gaz was like, well, that's all right, lad, if we're in a rock group. And I felt as though it wasn't my place and I was crestfallen. And I felt as though all the levers that were available to Gary weren't available to me. So I knew that I had to bide my time. I thought I was going to go off and be Robbie Williams. There was no sign. I hadn't started writing songs. You know, I hadn't put together a verse and a chorus and a verse and a middle eight and a double chorus out, you know. But I thought I was going to go off and play Nebworth, you know, and I must put that down to cocaine.
So it did some good then?
Yeah. While it was working, it did some good.
Sure.
And you sort of, if you adopt Oasis's personality and rock and rollness and aspire to be Jarvis Cocker, with a little bit of Radiohead, and you mix that with cocaine, you think that's what's going to happen. And actually what happened was I am built of jazz hands. You know, I'm a cabaret person. I'm from cabaret. Mm-hmm. And as much as my aspirations were to be Oasis, Radiohead, and a bit of Blur and Pulp, I can't help but being musical theatre. And that's what poured out of my soul.
So did the band come to a natural end then, or did you all have a fist fight?
I was a full-blown alcoholic addict at the end, and we were rehearsing for a tour, and our tours were very, very energetic. It was basically an hour and 45 of aerobics every night.
Sure.
I was in no state, A, to learn all the routines, and B, to physically be able to do it. So I'd made a shout to leave the band after the tour, and then they must have had their own separate meeting about this and decided that I should leave before the tour starts. And they sort of gave me that opportunity one day at lunch in a rehearsal room in Stockport at the TA barracks. And I grabbed that opportunity and left.
Great. Well, I remember exactly at that same time, I'd recorded some demos and I went to London to see somebody called David Enthoven, who we both know extremely well. Sadly, not here. And I walked into his office and I played the demos to him. And he said, you know what? I just met this guy called Robbie Williams and I think I'm going to have my hands full. And he did.
Yeah, he really did. Because Dave and Tim became my managers. And Dave was 10 years sober. Mm-hmm. And I was 10 years unsober. And he could recognize that. And basically, Dave and Tim came to my flat that I was renting in Maida Vale, which I would say is the epicenter of my worst using days. And I can remember telling them the poetry that I'd written. And I can remember their eyes lighting up and them being impressed.
Yeah.
And I could tell that, I'm a thing. No, I'm a real thing because I can do a thing, you know. And they basically, in return, were like, yes, that's the thing. Oh, okay, good. Will you look after me? But I wasn't sober. And I didn't know at that point that I was ready to be sober.
Right. But was it not the time to make that switch, because you were working with somebody who ultimately became a mentor as well as a manager, I would imagine?
I got very, very lucky. I got very, very lucky in lots of different ways. You know, my daughter, who's 8, was telling me things were unfair, you know, the other day. And I was like, babe, if things were fair, Rufus Wainwright and John Grant would be playing stadiums and I wouldn't be. Mm-hmm. It being unfair is okay. I just absolutely fucking lucked out with Tim and Dave. I won't get into where I had been and who with.
Sure.
But it was film worthy, book worthy, and very much tabloid headlines worthy. If people actually knew where I'd been and who with before I found Tim and David, it was very much, you know, out of the frying pan, into the fire, into another frying pan. And then Tim and David came, and these two guys were like fathers. You know, they were like custodians of artists' rights, custodians of a record industry that had been perilous for anybody that's involved. And under absolutely every rock, at every turn, the artist gets ripped off. And sometimes it costs their life, to not to be dramatic. But you're lucky if you get ripped off financially. So I met Tim and Dave. And the way I explain what Tim and Dave is, Dave's the stroke and the creativeness, and Tim is the sledgehammer.
I totally agree.
And together, the chemistry was outstanding.
You know, for me anyway, they were the kind of people that would take your back, you know, and they would look after you, but they would love your music too. And they would enhance everything that you wanted to do as an artist. And that's what a good manager should be doing, should be holding your hand.
Yeah, well, for me, I love the fact that they'd listen to stuff that I'd done and then go, let's pick the most bonkers one. We sort of led albums with songs that probably no one will remember now, but they were like mental. So instead of it being, okay, we've definitely got this mid-tempo ballad thing taken care of, they would pick like the electronic nonsense lyric where I'm just trying to be, I am the walrus, unsuccessfully. But they would gravitate towards the unconventional, which made me very happy.
You know, that day when I went around there with my demos, the thing that they were talking about you, Robbie, was your lyricism. And, you know, because I'd only seen you in Take That, I hadn't seen any or heard any of that. And they played me a couple of demos. I can't remember what they were. And I was blown away that you'd kind of been pushed to one side in that way.
I think if you asked Nigel Martin-Smith and Gaz, they may not have known, but there was a overriding energy of this isn't your place.
Yeah.
And you act accordingly.
Alongside our weekly guests, in each episode, we'll be meeting other musicians from around the UK who've been supported by Help Musicians during these turbulent and troubling times during COVID. The charity has provided 1,200 musicians with mental health care. These beneficiaries are singers, songwriters, composers from rock and pop and classical, and they're all here to tell their story.
My name is Ruth Lyon. I was previously known as Ruth Patterson, and I am a singer-songwriter from Newcastle upon Tyne. Holy Moly and the Crackers is a 6-piece folk rock band, and we've toured all over Europe. We've played Glastonbury, Boomtown, all of the major festivals. And 2 years ago, I decided to also start a solo project as a singer-songwriter, and the music is quite different, based around piano and a bit more reflective, I guess. The last year has been really difficult, just like it has for everybody, but I do feel quite positive about how it's gone. The band basically toured non-stop from 2015 onwards. As soon as I finished my fashion degree, we were on tour. And we were touring like over 100 shows a year all across Europe, and we never really had a day off. So I think it took a worldwide pandemic to stop us. I don't think we were ever going to stop had it not been for this. And I think I really needed it, actually. My band was on a six-week tour of Europe when the border started to close 2 weeks into that tour. So we had to scrap 4 weeks of a six-week tour, which was obviously financially crippling to our business, and also just really sad and really scary time. We had a race back. I think we were in the van for 16 hours just to try and get back over the border because we were just terrified we were going to get stuck. So although it's been hard, you know, financially difficult, and, you know, I've missed my pals, I've missed being on the road, I've missed the shows, I think there's been a positive spin on it as well. Help musicians were really vital at the start of the pandemic. It was just really good because it just meant that, yes, we're having a terrible time and this crazy, scary thing is happening, but at least we know we can pay our bills. It's a career-changing moment when you do get this type of funding. It's really important for your mental health not to be scraping by all the time. Creatively as well, like if you can relax and have that time and that space to think, knowing that your basics are covered, that's great. It means that you can create more freely. And that's something that I've found so helpful with the funding that I've been able to get. It's just like being able to breathe. That's how I'd describe it. It's such a weight off your mind.
Help Musicians is a charity for music creators of all genres across the UK, providing a lifetime of support when it's needed most. To find out how they can help you or to support their work, find them on all social media platforms or visit helpmusicians.org.uk. One of the great memories for me is coming to see you at Wembley with Take That maybe 10 years ago. And the band came out before you and they did that run down the walkway, which seemed to take everybody's breath away. And then you did this amazing thing coming out on a wire from the top of the lighting rig.
Yeah.
And it was like, yeah, this is the guy you want to see.
Yeah, I came out at the top of the lighting rig upside down on some wires, which I've done sort of several times with my tours too. And that daredevil stuff kind of feels like the best thing and the best way to attack the space at the start of a tour. But as the tour goes on, you realize that if this thing breaks or collapses, I'm dead. So you kind of spend the first 10 or 12 shows going, I'm amazing, no one else will do this. And then you spend the rest of the tour going, I can't wait for this bit to be over because I don't want to die.
But what I suppose I was trying to say was, like, the band were good and all that. They were sort of totally in tune and everything. But you came out and just completely got it by the throat. And it seemed to me when I looked at the other members of the band, it was like, okay, this is Robbie's stage.
Well, I'm a showman and there's not many of me about that is willing to make themselves look a tit or be pompous or throw a shape or fill that space. And filling the space has been a necessity for me because, and I think it can be a detriment to young people, you know, I didn't grow up being an incredible singer at all. You know, I could hold a tune. So I grew up with a complex that my voice wasn't that great. Because I was going to be an actor. I actually thought, I'll be an actor. I'd like to be a singer, but I don't think I can sing that well. So that's been a gift to me because I've just done things around the voice where I'm going, look at this, don't listen to this, look at this, watch me do this. You know, so it's been a gift and a curse. It's like I've instinctively known that I need to fill the space with something other than a glorious voice because I've not been gifted in the voice range. What I do is uniquely me, and neither is Sean Ryder, but I love Sean Ryder, you know, and neither really has Madonna. But if you tell me there's two shows to go and watch, one's Madonna and another one is a classically trained or incredible vocalist, I'm going to go see Madonna.
You know, for the show.
For the show.
Yeah.
Yeah, so when you say the stage was mine, my learning the bar chords and learning to pick the guitar, which I couldn't do, it's not my thing, was showing off. I've got 10,000 hours in showing off. That is my thing that I'm naturally attuned to, is being a show off. And because of that, it fills a stage and it fills a stadium.
And that comes from maybe being in the pub as a young boy and adults coming in and saying how great you are and you jumping around on sofas and what have you.
You know, there was a jukebox and Grease was a big film at the time. And I'd be 3 years old miming to Summer Nights. And there wasn't a time when being a show off wasn't in my life.
Sure, yeah. But can you sit down at home with an acoustic guitar and write on your own?
There was one album that I did called Intensive Care with Stephen Duffy. And it was a great process where he was very patient and let me sit with the bass guitar until I came up with the bass line and then figure out where the pre-chorus went. And then it would take fucking hours, you know, but I did it. And I have to say, I got my jollies with that on that album, but it's not my bag.
No.
You know, I gave up trying to concentrate. If you said to me, if my life depended on it now, go and sit down with the guitar, write a song, build the structure, make sure that it's interesting and make sure that it's better than shit. Yeah, I could do that. I've done it several times, but it's not my thing.
It isn't your thing, but I think there's a whole audience that want to hear the story of Robbie. And when you haven't got all the bells and whistles, that's who you are. You know, like when you listen to a Joni Mitchell song, you hear Joni and you hear the story that she tells. And there's that story within you too. There's a serenity, there's a whole depth of human being, the guy that was like me, who had dyslexia, but was told he was backward.
Backward, yeah.
Backward, can you imagine that now? But, you know, like that Johnny Cash record that was produced by Rick Rubin. You know, just the voice is like the storytelling voice. And that's what you have. You are the show off, but you've got a fantastic storytelling voice.
Thank you. I realize now, and this is from experience of being a 47-year-old that couldn't say one decent thing about myself, even though I know to the general public that I look pompous and arrogant when I perform and stuff. I couldn't jot down one nice thing to say about myself. I just absolutely hated myself. And I'm realizing as a 47-year-old, I can say I'm a good storyteller and I'm not stupid.
Mm.
This is all kind of like brand new stuff and a brand new way of thinking. It's taken me up until the last 3 years to come to a place where I can say nice things about myself.
That's great.
And yeah, I agree. Thank you. I'm a storyteller. And when I get it right, I get it really right.
You do. Do you have a memory of something being really ultra amazing, like the highest point of your career that you would say, wow, I wish I could do that again?
No. The whole of my entire career, all the massive high bits were married with a very, very dark depression and a very, very deep anxiety. Mm-hmm. And none of it was enjoyable. And the fact that none of it was enjoyable made it even more deeply distressing and made me deeply unhappy, because I'd been given the golden ticket. I pulled the one-arm bandit and it had come in sevens, and I'm being shown the best of the best at the highest of the highest, the most record sold, the most ticket sold, the biggest crowds. None of it touched me. none of it did anything other than scare the living daylights out of me and depress me. And I know that that's not an uncommon story.
Yeah. It's not, no. But it's very deeply felt as well, isn't it, as somebody who is a show-off, if you like, to have those feelings, to own those feelings and to be Robbie.
Do you know, I used to be on stage and in my head, I'd think, what have you cunts come to see this cunt for? And I'd be the cunt. I'd be that guy. Like, I'd have self-hatred for me and then I'd have self-hatred for my audience for coming. You know that thing with the Groucho Marx, I wouldn't want to be a member of blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Of a place that had me as a member. The self-hatred was so heavy and intense.
Is it gone?
I don't know if it ever leaves. It's not as extreme as it used to be. Actually, I don't live there anymore. I used to live there. I might weekend there occasionally every 3 months.
Beautiful.
But it's not the place that I live in now. It's not driving the car.
No.
You know, somebody that is more content is driving the car.
Are you working on new stuff now?
I've got 71 songs in the bank. 71 songs. And I've done 500 pieces of art.
Wow. Excellent. You lazy bugger.
Yeah, that's what I've been doing through COVID.
Wow. And what's your artwork of art like? What is your art like? What do you lean towards?
I watched a documentary called Exit Through the Gift Shop about Banksy.
Oh, yeah.
And in the documentary, he turns the camera on Mr. Brainwash. Mr. Brainwash is supposed to be doing the documentary about Banksy. And Mr. Brainwash goes off and becomes an artist out of not being one. And I thought, well, I'm creative. I wonder if I shine my light over here. I wonder if I can make something that looks arty. And people are being very, very responsive towards what I'm creating in a very, very positive fashion. So I've done 80 of these bigger works that are currently on a container going from Los Angeles to the UK. And I've done 400 smaller works. Some are in Europe and a lot of them are over here in Los Angeles. The bigger works are done with floor paint and a squeezy bottle and abstract shapes with characters on it. I would say that it's Murakami mixed with Basquiat mixed with me.
Sounds great. Sounds really good.
And it's not shit. You know, it's a thing. And I'm really proud of it.
Have you seen Joni Mitchell's artwork to talk about her?
Yeah. I did an abstract Joni Mitchell.
Did you?
Yeah, I did an abstract Joni Mitchell. And it's shit.
So just before we go, have you heard of Help Musicians at all?
Well, not until I heard it from... that it was written that you are connected with Help Musicians. Tell me about Help Musicians.
Well, they're a charity that have been going for 100 years, and during COVID, they given out like £17 million of grants to songwriters who have dyslexia and live in dark places, and they gave them the ability to survive during this time, I guess, or try and survive. And... it's the only part of the music industry that I've found any empathy during this time. I don't know if you've felt any empathy during this time.
I'm kind of a corporation, you know. People don't feel empathy for corporations. I'm Robbie Williams that's had the career that I've had. So my empathy has come from my wife. You know, it's like I'm not in a dark place anymore.
Mm.
I'm not in a lonely, dark place. Depressive place anymore. She's with my children and I feel content and I love my wife. So
wonderful.
There's nothing really to have empathy about.
Mm.
But I know what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, I was pointing towards people like Spotify and, you know, the major labels not being able to be more generous with younger writers and sort of give them a hand up during this time, which is a shame because people like David and Tim, they would have been straight on the phone to try and sort stuff out for people.
Yeah, but the record companies, it might as well be biscuits.
Sure.
You know, it might as well be biscuits or it might as well be an energy drink.
Hmm.
You know, they're going to have the same amount of empathy for the artist that they're going to have for Red Bull. You're looking in the wrong place, you know, and they won't and you can't expect them to because it's business.
Sure.
And business is capitalist and capitalism has no heart.
Sure. What do you miss most about David?
Everything. Absolutely everything. He was my mentor. He's a father figure. He turned up in a dream not so long after he passed away. And he was leaning against a wall and I was walking down a street and I saw him and I shouted, David! And he looked at me and he pointed up towards heaven and he smiled and winked and then disappeared.
Wow.
Which was obviously super, super powerful.
I remember calling him once when I was feeling really dark and lonely and down and not knowing what to do. And he said, you know what, Diffie? Have a Twix. Like that with Kira, you know.
Do you know, yeah, and momentarily it would. At his funeral, I couldn't believe the amount of people that were walking up to me and telling me he'd saved their lives. It was unbelievable. I was just overwhelmed with person after person after person just going, David saved my life. And he saved mine.
Yeah, and mine.
He saved mine a couple of times. And
he's there for us both.
Sorry. I really miss him.
Yeah, I do. What an incredible person.
Yeah.
Robbie?
Yeah.
Have a Twix, mate.
I think I will have a Twix.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Robbie, for giving us your time and your love. And I really want to hear the story of Robbie in a song, in songs, in a kind of like an acoustic, not showing off kind of way, but just Robbie, because your story is so beautiful. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Difford. Absolute pleasure. And always feels great when I'm in your company. Seldom happens, but whenever I am, you make me feel safe.
Grand. God bless you.
All right, mate.
Cheers.
Lots of love. Be well.
See you too. Bye.
Bye.
I have to admit, I was quite nervous at the beginning of this podcast talking to Robbie Williams, but somehow he made me feel at home and at ease. He's such a lovely guy, he really is. We have lots of things in common, although I have to say I've never danced on stage in my underpants. Thank you so much, Robbie Williams. Thanks for listening to I Never Thought It Would Happen with me, Chris Difford. You can find out more about Help Musicians at www.helpmusicians.org.uk. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and please leave us a review, hopefully a good one. We'd love to know what you think and who you'd like us to feature in future shows. See you on the next episode and keep coming back. I Never Thought It Would Happen is a Gimme Sugar production for Help Musicians.